The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Morning. I want to thank Fusho, who's live casting, whatever it's called, on Facebook. And the last time you did this, someone contacted me, a friend from California, who said he was doing his laundry and folding his clothes and listening to my Dharma talk. Thanks to you, Fusho. So I hope, Tom, you're doing your laundry again. So welcome to all of you here for our Sunday program. Yesterday we had an all-day sit, which was good and strong, and it kind of that, and today welcomes us back after our August, we have a little, had a two-week hiatus and gave us time to really scrub and clean the Zendo and get things back together for September, and ourselves, get ourselves back for September. And tomorrow, you may know, is Rosh Hashanah. That's the Jewish New Year. So, you know, we can all take advantage of that, whether we're Jewish or not. And we can say, okay, maybe it's time to renew ourselves, to consider our lives and how we're living and how we want to move forward in our lives. So, Happy New Year. And I think that's what draws most of us to Zen. To practice in a meditative and spiritual tradition that can hold us and simultaneously free us. Help us to serve the wholeness of life. To the one body of life, to be able to recognize that there's something outside of our own little cloud of being, that there's all of being, and that we are part of it. So the question is, of course, for all of us, whether we've been practicing for 1 minute or 40 years, is how do we do this over and over again? How can we really enter the Dharma? How can we really express the teachings? And of course, there are many, many paths. And there are also many Buddhist paths, ways of practicing. Zen is just one way. But somehow, those of us here in this room have gathered to practice that way. We don't know why. It just happened. Something attracted us. Often, you know, it's just chance, a word, a reading, a convenience. You know, we're in the neighborhood. We're on the right subway line. Somehow we find a resonance. And so we continue to explore. We find some kind of path for ourselves. And it's not easy to discern at first. But step by step, we enter the way. And we find our own way. Maybe we begin with the Zen meditation, simply practicing. And maybe we begin to study some of the Zen teachings, reading, maybe working with a teacher, attending retreats, classes. Maybe we like it, maybe we don't. Maybe we like some parts we don't. But somehow we feel that there's something there for us, and so we keep on going. Something healthful and alive. Something that can benefit us. And vaguely, we may also recognize that it's something that can benefit others, too, through us. In Buddhism, we call that bodhicitta. Bodhi means awakened or awakening, or Buddha, bodhi. And citta means mind, discriminating mind specifically, the awakened mind, the mind that's free of our dream-like delusions. It is a mind that's ready to serve all of life. It's our bodhicitta. So that's really great, whether we are aware of it or not. There is a rising in everyone here right now is a kind of mind of awakening. Our own bodhicitta. It's a joyful thing. Consider the whole universe, the Buddha-seeking mind, the awakened-seeking mind is rare. You know, in our competitive, grasping, greedy, selfish world that we live in, it's wonderful to run into someone with bodhicitta. Huh? The human who chances to find Buddhism, to find a practice that works for them, and who desires to be enlightened, to save all sentient beings, and engages in a practice to discover the way to do that, it's rare. And everyone's here, sitting here today, has started on that road. So there's the first thought of enlightenment and the daily experience of that aspiration, that desire to be awakened, pushes us along, keeps our practice alive. So I'm not just talking about Zazen coming to this Zendo or any Zendo. And I'm not just talking about chanting, being in a community, but it's the experience of being alive to your practice. Being alive to your practice. Of meeting difficulty, conflict, joy and love, meeting all of it with this Buddha-seeking mind, this mind that seeks to be awake and alive to what's arising now. So without bodhicitta, our practice is dry and intellectual, or meaningless ritual. Take care of your bodhicitta. Dogen, you know, the founder of our Soto Zen sect, once wrote in one of his fascicles that there are three things that can easily spoil before they ripen. Fish eggs, mangoes, and bodhicitta. The mind of enlightenment can spoil, just like fish eggs and mangoes. So the fish eggs and mangoes are very fragile. And they're fecund. They're alive. Think of the smell of fish eggs and mangoes, huh? Really ripe. and the aliveness and fragility of our own Buddha-seeking mind, our own awakening-seeking mind. You know, we know that in every nanosecond, things change and our minds change. We know that. We know that intellectually and viscerally, particularly if you've got a headache or had something happening to you. You're aware of the moment-to-moment changes that happen. And so too does our Bodhi mind, our Bodhicitta, changes, fluctuates. Just like our attention does in Zazen. Constant change. And yet, once we have recognized our bodhicitta, there's a disposition of our being, of our body-mind, that continues to seek and to attain the way. So that is marked by our openness to learn, the beginner's mind that we talk about, a humility that allows us to be flexible, to be in each moment and ready to atone when we slip up, to correct ourselves, to come back to our Buddha-seeking mind. So Dogen quotes Shakyamuni Buddha when he says, a bodhisattva must never fail to protect their Buddha-seeking mind. They should do this as people protect their children, as a one-eyed person protects their good eye, or as a traveler passing through wilderness protects their guide. For it is the Buddha-seeking mind that finally lends itself to awakening, to supreme enlightenment. How could we not protect it? If, in fact, we are aware that there's a way to practice, how could we not protect that? But the reality is we don't. Constantly let it slip away from us. We let our mind slip into all kinds of places. I'm angry, or complacent, or arrogant, or impatient with ourselves, with our life, with our practice, with our sangha, with our karma, with ourselves. Or we can become fixated on one idea of what the Dharma is. Rather than actually embodying the Dharma, we say, ah, I got it. This is what the Dharma is. Whoops. And how we deal with those things that keep us from practicing, that's where our bodhicitta comes in. That's how we either nourish or poison our bodhicitta, our Buddha-seeking mind. How we deal with those challenges, with our doubts, our difficulties, how we do that is what sharpens and enlivens our bodhicitta. So today I just want to talk a little bit about one way that we can get stuck in a fixed idea about the teachings and thus dull our bodhicitta. We can become fixed in the way things are. And we become like sleepwalkers, dreaming our idea of Zen. So I'm going to talk a little bit about a koan that we study in our, we have a year-long class, many of you know about it, The Path of the Koan this year. And you know, koans, just to explain, are briefly short stories that have been handed down since, you know, the medieval period in China. And they're stories that if you listen to them, there's an essence there. There's something there that will teach us something. And in this class that we have, people share how they experience these koans. And so it's quite fun. Sometimes there are poems, and sometimes there are rants, and sometimes very, very beautiful expositions of a people's minds and how they work with these koans. But the heart of all of these koans is how to be really intimate with the teachings and not take them as some other thing that will explain something. So what we try to do, and also in our interviews, is to look at the teachings from different perspectives, from the perspective of my own personal life. That's the heart of it, how this koan affects my own personal life. And also how this koan reflects the teachings, the Dharma teachings that we hear about, that we read about, that are kind of like the larger structure of the teachings, the Buddhist teachings. And finally, how does it reflect it in the world that we live in? Because we don't live alone. We live in this vast and troubled world now that is suffering. So I'm going to try and treat this one short koan in the way that we do in the class, because this is the koan that we're working on this month. It's from both the Blue Cliff Record and the Book of Serenity, and it's called Nan Quan's Peony. Officer Lu Gang said to Nan Quan, "Teaching Master Zhao was quite extraordinary when he was able to say, 'Heaven and earth have the same root. Myriad things are one body.'" Nan Quan pointed to a peony in the garden and said, "People today see this flower as if in a dream." So Officer Lu Quan says to Nan Quan, "Teaching Master Zhao was quite extraordinary. He was able to say, 'Heaven and earth have the same root. Myriad things are one body.'" Nan Quan points to a flower in the garden, a peony, and he says, "People today see this flower as if in a dream." Now, Nan Quan, you may know him from other koans as Nansen, which is the way Japanese pronounce his name, was one of the very greatest of Zen teachers. He was the teacher of Joshu and Xuansha, and he lived in the golden age of Zen, studying with Master Mazu. He has said that after he received the transmission, he went off by himself to live on a mountaintop for 30 years before he began to teach. So probably not true, but it's lovely to think of that. And Officer Lu Gang appears in quite a few koans. He was an officer, a layman, a judge, in the equivalent of the Chinese Supreme Court, and very accomplished Zen person. So there's another story about him that when he first went to Nan Quan, he asked Nan Quan a question, a riddle, to see if he was a good enough teacher. And the riddle he gave him was, "I've raised a goose in a bottle, and it gradually grew too big to get out. Now, without damaging the goose or the bottle, how would you get it out?" Now, that's the riddle. Nan Quan called out to him, "Sir." Taifu. Lu Guang said, "Yes." Nan Quan said, "It's out." And that was Lu Guang's awakening. So that story, the reason I told it is that it hints at, you know, Liu Gang's tendency to lose himself in lexical, in words, in arguments, and to get caught up in a conceptual ideation, conundrums. And it also shows how Nan Kuan was able to shake him out of it, come out of the bottle, reminding him of the intimacy of true reality, not this conceptual riddle. This right now. Anyway, in the case that I'm a peony, Nan Kuan and Liu Gan are walking in the garden. Maybe you can imagine that. There's a tiny garden outside my apartment. I walked through it this morning. It's very beautiful. It's damp. Flowers and plants, scent of green. And in the midst of all of this, Liu Gang, you know, just kind of overwhelmed by it all. And he says, teaching Master Zhao was quite extraordinary. He was able to say, heaven and earth have the same root. Myriad things are one body. That's very profound. He was quoting a well-known Chinese master, Jing Zhao, who worked with the early translations with Kumarajiva, and was inspired by the teachings of the Vimalakirti Sutra. So this is a great master he's quoting, a very early one. Very respected, appreciated by all the Zen teachers. He says, he quotes him, he says, heaven and earth have the same root. 10,000 things are one body. Can you argue with that? It's very Zen. It's very Buddhist. All is one. I don't know, what's the problem with that? What's the problem with that? All is one. This is what I used to do. So I can sort of imagine Nan Kuan smiling, you know, as he bends towards this single peony and says, people these days see this flower as in a dream. What is he seeing? What is he pointing to? As if in a dream. Jing Xiao's maxim is to the point, you know. Heaven and earth have the same root. The 10,000 things are one body. Yet when Officer Liu Geng says it, it's sort of like, you know, when we read an inspiring quote in the morning or a book before we go to sleep at night. Yes. And it works for a few hours, you know. And then it's gone. Or even worse, it's not gone. And we stick to it. And we're quoting someone else's experience. Taifu, people nowadays see this bunch of flowers as if they are in a dream. So we have to ask ourselves, when we read this koan, what is it that I see as if in a dream? What is it that I really believe that is a dream? Your idea of enlightenment? Of what practice is? Of morality? Politics? Of Buddha nature? What do you see as if in a dream of who you are or who others are that you relate to every day, as if in a dream? We abstract our understanding so quickly. We make a form for it, and we push people and things into that form. And that's what cuts off our feelings, cuts off our creativity, and truncates our experience of now. And we do this by habit. It's easy. To not meet reality is really easy if you're just meeting the dream. We also do it by not paying attention, not being on the sharp edge of reality, and by fear. We don't want to see it. We don't trust our own experience. And so we overlay it with dead words and old ideas, fantasies. We think that someone else's experience is the experience we should be having. And we miss the moment, our own freshness, our own aliveness. Fresh and alive as those fish eggs and mangoes. So you could say that on a Dharma teaching level, that's the point of the koan. Words are not the thing itself. This koan reminds us not to get fixed or glued to a dreamlike fantasy of our experience as it has been described by someone else, be it a Zen master or whomever. When we rely on the words of others, we're separating from our true nature as if we are in a dream. This summer at the Grail workshop, I gave a writing retreat. And during it, I can't remember what the prompt was, but I remembered my very first sesshin, the first time I went on a long, week-long retreat. And it was really only after, it was the first time I had attended a Zen retreat center. So, I mean, talk about crazy, going the first time you go to a retreat center and you sign up for a 10-day retreat, not having any idea what you're doing. Because I had spent the last 20 years of my life reading about Zen. So I was quite convinced I knew everything that needed to be known about it, not having sat. Yeah. So thinking about that, I just remembered it during the poetry retreat, and you know, we were working on haiku at that time, so I wrote a haiku about that time, and I entitled it "Midlife, the Dharma Came into Me," and the koan is, I mean, the haiku is, "It was so easy that scorching summer retreat to drop my old face. It was so easy that scorching summer retreat to drop my old face." And so what do I mean by my old face? Well, it was only my mid-30s. The knowing face. The face that reads and understands as if the Dharma is something to read and understand. That summer, in a rigorous sesshin, I was worn down enough by the heat and the long hours of sitting in silence to just, you know, it was almost brutal. It was so intense that my understanding just dropped away. The dream of Zen fell away. All the things I knew about it fell away. And I found myself just experiencing moment by moment. Just this. In my haiku, I say it was so easy, but it wasn't. It didn't feel that way. It felt really hard, unfamiliar, strange. To not be able to hold on to an idea, to not be able to hold on to a phrase, but to simply be, to simply sit in silence without categorizing and theorizing and making. And I realized that there were no words. My experience didn't fit into any language. I didn't understand it. I didn't understand it. And of course, after the retreat ended, I slipped right back into my ordinary way of being. But something had shifted. My old face of knowing, of the dream of Zen, had slipped. And it took many years to sort that out, before I could just allow the world to flow into me and out of me with bodhicitta, coming and going, realizing, not realizing, walking and stumbling, even today, theorizing. So you could say that's my personal understanding of this koan. Parallel to the teaching, parallel to the Dharma level, but with how I personally met that koan, can wake from my dream. And, you know, it's not time, but there are other ways to investigate this koan. When we drop the dream, when we face the world we're living in, the crisis we're living in, with bodhicitta, what can we do? Wansung, who collected these, made a commentary on this koan, and it's great. If you say the meaning of the teachings is the ultimate principle, then why did Buddha still hold up a flower? Why did Bodhidharma still come from the West? He's saying, if you say there's just this moment to moment, why did these people serve the world the way they did? Why didn't they just keep sitting? Why did Buddha get up and go and teach for 40 years? Why did Bodhidharma cross the sea? Why do you help a friend? Why do you vote? Are you going to vote? Did you vote? Will you vote? Will you be sure that everyone you know votes? Oh, excuse me. Why do you write letters to prisoners? Why do you recycle and compost? Why do you attend political meetings, sign petitions, volunteer? Why do you open the Zendo at noontime? I'm asked that all the time because, you know, like two or three people come. Why? Why do we staff the Zendo at noontime all week long? Why did Bodhidharma come from that India to China. Isn't that the way our hearts open? When we see that the whole world is in us, and we in it, then our selfishness and fear drop away, and we care. It's not the idea of enlightenment. It's a real thing. So let me just end with this verse. It is not a dream. Let's wake up over and over, offering what's needed.